911, what's your emergency?
What is the address of your emergency?
911.
911, what's the nature of your emergency?
911, what is your emergency?
Police department.
May 8th. A black Yale student naps in a dorm common area, and a white student calls the police.
You got your ID on you?
Yeah, I do.
All right, can we see that?
Why?
We got a police call for you.
We need to make sure that you belong here.
Okay, let me open my apartment for you so that you can see that I belong here.
April 30th. A parent calls campus police at Colorado State University when two Native American prospective students join a tour group. She said she found them suspicious.
What's in there? Is there anything in here? Just your money?
There's a magnet in there.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, so the reason we stopped you is talk to you. Somebody from the group called, said that you guys just kind of came into the group.
Yeah, we were late.
Also April 30th, a woman calls the police on a group of people she describes as burglars. They were three black women checking out of an Airbnb.
There's like three black people stealing stuff.
Stealing stuff?
Yeah. Like breaking into the house and taking
people. No, we're taking our suitcases out of the house.
Right. They said like luggage and stuff.
Because there's three black people in the neighborhood, of course.
April 21st. Five black women go golfing, and when they don't golf fast enough, a group of white male golfers calls the police on them to make them leave.
It's 1:28. You got off the green at not 12:45.
And so they're saying they want to kick us off the hole.
Let the police handle.
And this is former Commissioner Steve Cronister.
Congratulations. You're a real winner.
April 12th. Two black men sit in a Starbucks waiting for a friend. Staff ask them to leave, and when they don't, staff member calls the police, and the men are handcuffed and arrested.
What did they get called for? Because there are two black guys sitting here meeting me?
Yes, I didn't.
Well, what did they do? What did they do? Someone told me they did.
They didn't do anything. I saw the entire thing.
What did they do?
And on and on and on. Americans calling the police to report other Americans of color, even where there's been no crime. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. So what makes you pick up the phone to dial 911? Is it witnessing a crime? Is it some sort of suspicion of shady activity? How you answer that question may depend on the color of your skin and on the color of the skin of the person you fear is up to no good. The examples are flooding our social media feeds. They're just piling up. So what do we do? Where do we go from here? Jason Johnson is politics editor at TheRoot.com, and he's also a professor at Morgan State University in Baltimore. Jason, hello.
Glad to be here.
Why are people picking up the phone and calling 911?
They're racist. I mean, that's the most basic answer. But I think an even more important question is, why are we seeing it now, right? And the easy answer is to say, oh, well, it's social media, it's technology, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not why, right? We've always had these kinds of problems. What's happened is there has been a shift in this country. There are large numbers of white Americans who are now empathetic to this kind of daily harassment by people of color, which is making media outlets interested in bringing that story to the public.
Now, let's dig a little deeper into the sort of the reasons behind some of these calls. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are surrounding suspicion or I'm scared. I felt, quote unquote, uncomfortable. What does this have to do with white Americans who are largely the ones behind these calls? I mean, I can't say every single one has been by a white person, but largely what we're seeing. What does this tell us about this idea of discomfort in America?
The majority population in America often believes that they are the owners of any and all spaces in which they're in. And when other people are there, it is at their sort of benevolence. I go to the Starbucks as a white person, and I like being around other white people, and the blacks and the Hispanics and the Asians and the LGBT people who are there because they make me feel good about myself that I'm in such a diverse environment. But the moment that the existence of these other people is uncomfortable or isn't what they want or what they expect in the environment, they believe that they can basically use the police as their own racism valets to remove any people of color that make them uncomfortable. So most of this behavior, it doesn't matter whether it's conscious or whether it's unconscious. It's the belief that I can control who is in my space and I can come up with any justification that I want. And if you think about it, would a man be able to call the police and say, hey, there's a woman walking around this basketball court. She's making me uncomfortable. No, the police would never show up for that reason. If a woman said, hey, there's a man walking around the bathroom, I feel uncomfortable. The police wouldn't show up unless he did something. But someone saying there's a person of color nearby automatically is considered valid by the police departments in this country, by campus cops in this country, and they feel compelled to go and pursue whatever sort of bias or racist agenda this person has.
And, so and that's I want to talk about the campus element specifically, right? Because we've seen Starbucks, we saw golf course. But we are also seeing this happening in universities.
I can say this as somebody who went to the University of Virginia undergrad and went to Chapel Hill to get my PhD. And I cannot tell you the number of times that I was not allowed into a building, that I was, you know, that someone let three people in and then looked at me and was like, I need to see your student ID, or pretended that I wasn't standing outside the library with my student ID trying to get in there. The problem on college campuses is it lays bare any of the pre-existing notions about threat or danger, because you're on a campus and 90% of the people on your campus are supposed to be there.
Are these callers, in your opinion, actually concerned about the harm that could result out of this, which goes far beyond harassment?
No, they don't care at all. And in fact, oftentimes the reason that they're calling is because they do want to inflict harm. The call itself is a threat. This is a piece I wrote a couple of weeks ago on The Root. You know, we need to talk about why white people keep calling the police on black people. And it's this idea of basically saying, I can't hit you, I can't use violence against you, but I can sanction state violence against you based on nothing other than the fact that I'm a white person. Because you look at the situation in Oakland, right? We have people barbecuing.
I hear you have a problem with these gentlemen having a barbecue here at the lake. What's going on?
Now she don't want to talk.
She doesn't want to talk now.
It's illegal to have a charcoal grill in the park here.
Now, first and foremost, what right does this woman have to determine who can and cannot barbecue? Right? It's not like they're talking on the quiet car or something where you can say it's a universal problem. These people are barbecuing. Not only did she feel the right to command where these people were, she also called the police, not because she was concerned, but because she wanted to threaten them.
The police did come.
Yes, the police came.
And what was the result of that?
So here's what's interesting. The result of that is the police, and this is why I think it's really important to talk about not just the callers, but the police themselves, right? There was a white woman who saw this other white woman making the call, and she's like, look, I'm going to stay here as a witness. And she stayed for almost 2 hours with the black family, sitting around socializing everything, because she recognized that when it came to the authority that the police would listen to, because she was a white woman, they would listen to her against this other white woman. And what happened? When the police arrived, they asked the caller questions, they asked the other white woman, they determined that there was nothing going on, and they left. No arrests, no tickets, nothing was handed out. This is the other part of this that I think we also have to talk about, even as we're talking about the people making these calls and the consequences they should face. It's this idea that police have a tremendous amount of agency when they reach a scene. Watch any episode of Cops. Okay, 90% of the time when cops are called to a situation, it's not worth their time. They show up and say, no, ma'am, you can't call the police because your husband hid the remote, right? So the fact that the police often show up in these situations when they're called on a person of color, they're basically given free rein to engage in the kind of violence they want to engage in anyway, because in most of these situations, if they had simply asked questions of both the caller and someone else involved, nothing would have happened. Starbucks, had the cops shown up and asked the store manager, what's your complaint? And she had been forced to explain what happened. And then they went and asked the young men, what's going on here? They'd have just left.
But those young men, okay, so much to unpack here. You mentioned the white woman who sat with the family and waited for the cops to show up at the barbecue. In Starbucks, we saw a similar thing. We saw white people say, well, wait a minute, I'm filming this. Nothing happened. What are you guys doing? But in that instance, the men were still taken out and handcuffed.
Right.
And my question to you is, what is the responsibility, if any, of passersby in these instances? Like, can and should people who see something like this happening intervene, whether it's effective or not, to say, look, I saw this entire thing play out and nothing happened?
Well, this is key. It's always good to be a witness, right? It's always good to be there and tell your story. But ultimately, the responsibility is not theirs. Ultimately, the responsibility is on the police, and ultimately, the responsibility is on local politicians and elected officials, county prosecutors, state prosecutors, city council. I have said this all along. The best way to solve this problem is to create consequences for this kind of behavior. This is malicious prosecution. That's all there is to it. If I pull a fire alarm and there's no fire, I get fined. If you call the police for malicious prosecution, for an absolute non-crime, the police should be able to say, you know what, $250 ticket. You wasted our time and you wasted the taxpayers' money because this guy was moving out of an Airbnb.
We asked our listeners about this topic, and I'd like to play you some calls.
This is Arius from Dallas, Texas. And this is not news. This is just news to white America. When it comes to overzealous, bigoted, and biased, quote-unquote, good Samaritans, they think they're helping, but they're not. And you couple that with overzealous, bigoted police officers, and that leaves a very large gray area for black and brown people that we've operated in for a very long time.
My name is Kate. I'm calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. I'll never call the police for a person of color in need without their express wishes. Police just aren't safe for people of color, especially black people. Because I'm tall and white, I use those two privileges to witness and video police interactions with black and non-black people of color. I don't think that any white people should be calling the police when they suspect, quote, air quotes, people of color of wrongdoing, especially those who are gentrifying neighborhoods. They need to learn their place.
She is expressing the kind of humanitarian community activism that everybody should engage in, right? If we didn't call the police as much as we do, if we actually learned how to have civil discourse with disagreements, then we would solve a lot of problems that we have in the community anyway. And as everyone always argues, the cops have plenty of stuff that they really need to be working on, not just, you know, because you spied somebody walking across the street. But she also says something else about using her privilege to combat these kinds of issues. I think it's important that people use their privilege. I think it's important that people use whatever kind of resources they do to make this a fairer and more decent world. But you got to vote. It has to be a larger structural response, because the idea of individual responses to systematic oppression won't work.
I want to ask you also about what this tells us about fear in the United States. I feel like just we talked a little bit about, I guess, what people would call, quote unquote, white fragility. But this is a bigger issue of fear.
Yeah.
This fear that we have of each other, this fear of the narrative that I think we've been hearing, particularly over the past year and a half, of this sort of brown menace of Americans who aren't white. I mean, can we get past this, or are we just going to see this type of fear of each other getting worse?
No, I mean, this is pretty standard. And even those individuals who make these calls to say, oh, my gosh, I had no idea what was going on. You knew that there was a possibility. That's why you made the phone call to begin with. But also people who are actively and intentionally and maliciously calling the police for that reason. And I've had that happen. I had a disagreement about a charge at a Red Roof Inn hotel when I was like driving through Pennsylvania several years ago. And I said, look, this is not the charge. This is the receipt, et cetera, et cetera. And the woman's immediate response is, I'll call the police. I'll tell them you're getting belligerent. That's a threat. It was a death threat. I mean, literally, we're talking about $25 on a bill. And she threatened to call the police because I said I wanted to speak to a manager. So, you know, again, there are people who have always been this way, and then we have a contingent of Americans who have been emboldened by this behavior because they know nothing's going to happen to them.
You mentioned your piece in theroot.com. I will be tweeting that out, and hopefully we'll have that available on our website. Jason Johnson is a professor in the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University in Baltimore and politics editor at theroot.com. Jason, thank you.
Thank you. Anytime.
And it's the end of week one for me here on The Takeaway. But the conversation we started about identity in this country is only just the beginning. Me, beyond being a native New Yorker, a journalist, and a bit of a coffee lover, there are so many other layers to who I am. And I'm sure many of you feel the same way. So now it's your turn.
Hi, I'm Kevin from San Jose. And being a white male, I never had to think about who I am or where I am. And I've never actually felt like I belong to any one label, because none of them specifically describe me. Life isn't that simple.
I'm Pam Venn from St. Louis, Missouri, and I describe myself as an atheist Jew who celebrates Christmas and feels guilty about it.
My name is Dana. I'm from Evanston, Illinois. I work as a sign language interpreter for those who are deaf and hard of hearing, and many people identify proudly as deaf and as part of a cultural and linguistic minority in our country.
On Twitter, Jay Exless says, quote, I view myself as an African-American atheist. Both categories are hugely problematic in America. Also on Twitter, quote, I'm a black conservative who believes the Republican Party are not taking advantage of people like myself. We are here and ignored by the party. And we had a bunch of calls that reiterated that point.
Hi, my name is Addie, and I am calling from Virginia. I'm a black conservative, and I'm very disappointed in the party and the president. The party is currently focused on the chosen few, They failed to reach out to other black conservatives out there. We're hardworking, and frankly, we're doing very well, and we intend on doing to continue to do well and without jeopardizing our political beliefs. And we are here.
One of the least focused on communities are black and brown conservatives. All right, a few more calls from you.
Hello, I'm Oliver Sims. The older I get and the more racially related fatigue I experience, the more committed I am to being African American. I'm in the top 5% of income earners, master degreed, and successful by any measure. But when it comes down to perception and treatment, when a consumer, I'm a black man, plain and simple.
Hey, my name is Ana Hernandez, and I'm calling from New York City. I am Puerto Rican, poor. I answer to she, hers, his, they, theirs. All good. I grew up as a gender non-conforming trumpet-playing lesbian, and I think life is short, so you should show love now, because it's all about the relationships.
The label I use is wheelchair user, and everything from architecture to averting eyes shapes me daily. Ann Hart, Palm Desert, California.
I do not identify as an American.
Not an American. This voice stopped us in our tracks this week as we were debating labels and politics and race and faith in this country. And that's John Garhio Kane. He's a native activist and radio host and member of the Mohawk tribe.
I'm Mohawk, but that's not even our word. That's a word that is placed on us. I'm the Mohawk word. And I know this sounds strange, but the Mohawk word for Mohawk is Gunyagahaga.
John heard our coverage of this changing American identity and reached out to us to say, hey, I don't fall under this big American umbrella.
The reason I reached out to the program is because there are Native people, and I'm among them, who don't identify ourselves as Americans. We still maintain that we are Native, that we are Mohawks, Oneidas, Senecas. And this can go, you know, across what we call Turtle Island, that many of us identify ourselves as our original peoples. And we reject the notion of being forced into this American mosaic because it is our distinction and our autonomy and our sovereignty that we assert and that we promote and that we look to carry into the future.
There are 573 federally recognized tribes in the United States, but as a Mohawk, John doesn't seek federal recognition. While he lives on Native territory in upstate New York, John says he does not live on American soil and he does not feel American.
For Native people, we rarely have the opportunity to identify ourselves because we've been so misidentified and redefined by everybody from Hollywood to government to even the use of mascots. And I oftentimes talk about the unique racism that Native people experience, not suggesting that it's worse than any other form of racism, but it certainly is unique because of the history and because of who we assert that we are, not just a people looking for equality within the American system, but that distinction and that autonomy.
And it's interesting. I wonder if, you know, we're seeing a resurgence, obviously, in, or maybe not a resurgence, but an emergence in some cases of new labels and new forms of identifying. And often for communities of color in this country, a lot of that is trying to cut through the sort of colonialist, you know, ideas of assimilation and get right to the core of who we really are. Are you seeing this resurgence among younger Natives, where there's this sort of awareness that maybe wasn't there before, a connectedness to not so much to the United States of America, but to these sovereign ideals?
Well, part of it is really born out of the struggle for identity. And I think there is such confusion amongst Native people because of the history and because of so many oppressive policies that the United States has had over the years, including the one that they call assimilation, because it's still stripped away who we are. I mean, everything from the residential schools where the policy was kill the Indian, save the man. So the idea of, you know, cutting off the hair, forbidding the language, putting Native kids in uniform and trying to condition them to rid themselves of that primitiveness as it was labeled, and to strip that away. So what we have now It's been building since the 70s. What you have now are people, young people in particular, like you suggest, that are clearly confused about who they are. And do they have to be Americans because somebody said so? I mean, if you look at, you know, the legal basis for that, in 1924, the United States passes the Indian Citizenship Act, where they simply declare that all Native people are citizens. By the time you come out of World War II, it is clearly established that the idea of a nation trying to denationalize a population and impose their nationalized views on them is considered a war crime. Yet there you have this act of Congress in 1924 saying that all Native people are hereby U.S. citizens, even if we're not asking them to be. And I think many young people are becoming more and more aware of this. And part of it is the internet, the access to information. There's a lot more books being written and that kind of thing. But there's also a lot more conversation about the gaps in what we were taught as kids in the American public schools. And it's not just about making us angry about that history, but saying, wait a second, our history isn't the same as everybody else's history. So if our history is different, what does that mean about our present and what does that mean about our future?
And I want to talk about that a little. Native communities are often some of the least covered in the media and some of the least talked about when it comes to issues of identity and many of these other issues. Has the history, has this exploitation, has this lack of attention, if you will, and other forms of oppression shaped different Native communities and almost reinforced this idea of becoming independent and independent entities?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the whole idea of our identity has already been so manipulated by the outside. And of course, what is our relationship, you know, with the state and the federal government? And this is the challenge that we often have. We are still being pushed into complying with state laws, even on our own territories. And even with Andrew Cuomo, we're in a constant battle with this notion of native-to-native trade, suggesting that somehow we have to comply with state laws when there's no basis in law to suggest that. And we, as Native people, we can't travel internationally unless we get a U.S. passport. I mean, you go back to 2010, the Iroquois Nationals lacrosse team, which had traveled on Haudenosaunee passports, were denied the opportunity to go play at the World Games in Manchester, England, because the United States and Great Britain were indifferent about the use of Haudenosaunee passports. So the Iroquois Nationals didn't get to play in the World Games of lacrosse, which is kind of absurd all by itself. But so this whole notion that in spite of the fact that there is an international standard established by the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the United States still stands in stark violation of almost all of the articles of the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And in fact, you could argue that there's not a judge or a politician in the United States that will place enough priority on an international standard to say, well, maybe we need to rethink what that relationship is and how we go forward. So as more information and we are able to research our own histories a little bit, we've reclaimed much of what was stripped away by, you know, programs, by Hollywood, by the media, by, again, even by the use of mascots and that kind of thing. You know, when I was a kid growing up, there were a lot of Native kids who said, you know, yeah, they'd root for the Washington Redskins because there was nothing else.
I want to get to that point, though, right? Okay. There are kids that said they would root for the Redskins. I'm sure there are Natives who, people who will disagree with you, who will say, hey, I am an American and I identify with the tribe and those things can coexist.
Well, they can and they do. But when you put that question to somebody and you ask, are you an American or are you Navajo or are you Mohawk or are you Oneida or are you Seneca? All of a sudden they think, well, if there's a choice to be made, and then where do you prioritize? So is your identity really Seneca or is it really American? That question invites more questions. And those are the questions that rarely are we allowed to ask. I mean, everything from, you know, a Native kid being, you know, somewhat compelled to pledge allegiance to the, you know, to the flag or sing the national anthem, that kind of thing. This is still something that when a Native kid doesn't do that, they are still met with a lot of pressure, you know, to follow suit and to conform.
And why is it, in your opinion, so important for a sovereign identity to be preserved?
because we fade away otherwise. I mean, assimilation is still genocide. If you look at the definition of genocide, the idea of making a people, you know, disappear. And if you try to assimilate us or try to subjugate us or absorb us into the United States, then the question is, do we still exist?
Thanks so much, John.
All right. Thank you very much for having me on your program.
That was John Garjio-Kane, a native activist and radio host. Want to listen to any of our identity conversations this week? They're all up on thetakeaway.org. Tell us what you think over at our Facebook page.
Hey, thanks for checking out the Takeaways podcast. I know there are like hundreds of podcasts out there, so we really appreciate you choosing ours. And if you like what you hear, why not help spread the word? Like I said, a lot of podcasts, and you leaving us a rating or a review on iTunes will definitely help us stand out from the pack. Thanks in advance. Now back to the show.
The way I see it, you and me got one thing to talk about, and that's what you are willing to do for me.
You should reward me accordingly.
Which bothers some men. The word itself makes some men uncomfortable.
I volunteer as tribute.
Stick with me and we'll claw our way to the top.
Well, there's a first time for everything.
It's Friday, and you know what that means. I get to talk movies with you today. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway, and he's here with me in studio. Rafer, good to see you.
You too. Hi.
Hi. So, life of the party.
Dumbledore from, he's from Harry Potter. You know, Harry Potter's, like, mentor. He's got the beard, and he's got the hat. Dumbledore.
I'm gonna stop you right there. This is just kind of, this will ride you through life. I don't think ever there's a woman that's going to want you to say that during a sexual encounter, you're thinking of her as an old, gray, grizzled wizard. I mean,
so Rafer, this is Melissa McCarthy's latest. Give us your thoughts on it.
Yeah, she goes back to college. She plays Deanna, a housewife who is dumped by her husband. She decides she's going to go back to college and finish her degree, which just happens to be the college, of course, that her daughter is also attending.
Convenient.
Yes, very convenient.
Or not.
Right. Especially if you're the screenwriter, because then you can just copy Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield. Sort of very similar plot there. And, you know, it's a good role for Melissa McCarthy. I mean, she gets to play a very likable, lovable, you know, kind of doting mother figure, kind of nerdy. I think the problem is, even though this plays to Melissa McCarthy's strengths, this is one of the films that she has written and co-produced with her husband, Ben Falcone, who directs. And I feel like these McCarthy-Falcone comedies don't really quite work. Tammy, The Boss, if anyone out there has seen those, you know what I'm talking about. This is very similar. The story's just a little wobbly. That's one of the best jokes we just heard there. And that joke is kind of funny, but not great. And I think that's a real problem here. The movie just doesn't fly the way you want it to.
That's disappointing because I know she's got a lot of fans. Let's take a listen to our next film, The Seagull.
What does it feel like to be famous?
What does it feel like? Feels like not being famous, probably. I never think about it.
Well, what about when you read about yourself in the newspapers? What does that feel like?
Well, when they're flattering notices, I like it. And when they're nasty, I'm depressed for a day or two.
If I were great like you, I'd dedicate my whole life to my public.
Rafer.
That's The Seagull, the adaptation of the Chekhov play, of course, his first play. That's Corey Stoll, who plays the short story writer in the play. And that's Saoirse Ronan, a young country girl who is in falling in love with him. Great cast here. Annette Bening, Brian Dennehy, Mare Winningham. I mean, the list goes on. And a very interesting cast. A lot of people that you wouldn't think of necessarily in this movie. It's a really beautifully filmed adaptation, very creatively put together, I think. I love Chekhov. It is true that he is kind of the modern dramatist. When you watch this, it's very hard not to think of all the films that Woody Allen has made that have been trying to sound like Chekhov. It's really elegant, really wonderful film, and I really enjoyed this. It's in limited release. I think it'll probably be rolling out wider in the coming weeks.
Fantastic. We'll look to that. And our third film, let's take a listen.
Are you happy?
Yes, I am.
Have you been with other women?
No. Not really. And you?
No.
Do you still only fancy women?
And this was a clip from Disobedience. Tell us about this film.
Yeah, this is a film that's been out for a little while now, but it's rolling out wider. That's Rachel Weisz and Rachel McAdams playing two London Orthodox Jewish women who fall in love. They have sort of been in love since they were younger. Rachel Weisz's character leaves, comes back for a funeral, and they kind of rekindle this forbidden relationship. This film has had some sort of little polarized reviews, I guess. Some people have not been that impressed with it. I was just floored by it. I think the acting is great. We kind of expect that from Rachel Weisz, who I think has been in a lot of varied roles. A little less so from Rachel McAdams. You know, she's the actress with the weepy eyes who's in these kind of schlocky romances all the time, playing a kind of passive love interest. And here she's playing this very complicated, repressed, but also sort of sexually desperate woman who's in love with another woman in this very, restricted community. It's an amazing role. I have never seen her act like that. They're both just fantastic. And I thought it was a great script, very complicated, really vivid characters. And I just loved it. This is one of my favorite films so far of the year.
Really? And this is something that I think we're seeing a lot more of this in the canon of queer cinema, particularly,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. And films that I think, one thing I liked about this is that even though the forbidden romance is the main thing, it's really not the only thing. There's a lot of slices of this film that you could almost break off and make an entirely other, very satisfying, complicated, rich movie out of, these issues of family and religion. And it's all sort of folded in there. And I think it works really wonderfully.
Well, we've been having a conversation about identity throughout the week on the show, so this is a perfect thing to talk about. Last but not least, this is, I would say, a cult favorite it's slowly becoming. Let's take a listen.
When they would say things like this, how did you respond?
Well, never in anger, as my mother told me. That would have been self-defeating. Always as an opportunity to teach. I did see myself as kind of a kindergarten teacher in those days because the judges didn't think sex discrimination existed.
Oh, of course, we're talking about RBG, and many people will call her the notorious RBG,
right,
which is probably the most famous Supreme Court justice out today. Give us a sense of what this film was like.
Yeah, this is a documentary, very straight ahead, I think, trying to explain why we know Ruth Bader Ginsburg so well and why she's become this rock star, why she's become this meme, tattoos and coffee mugs.
T-shirts.
T-shirts,
yeah.
Everything. And, among people who are, almost a quarter of her age. And it does a really good job, I think, of explaining her history. If you didn't know her history as ACLU lawyer, making all these groundbreaking cases to kind of make a building block for equal rights for women, and then becoming, an associate justice on the Supreme Court. It's very straight ahead. It doesn't delve too deeply, I would say, but it does a good job of illuminating her backstory and explaining, why she's sort of taken the cultural position that she has.
And does she do her famous RBG workout in this at all?
Yeah, she does.
She does.
Yes.
This puts me to shame.
Medicine ball, TRX, the whole bit.
Unbelievable. Thank you, Rafer, for being with us today, and happy Friday to everyone. Next week, we'll be looking at the state of wealth in America, and we want to hear from you. Do you know how much wealth you have? Try this little exercise. Add it all up, your income, your inheritance, your assets, and subtract your debt. And that gives you the answer. What allowed you to build wealth? What prevented it? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us your story. Or leave us a voice memo at our website at thetakeaway.org/mytake. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with me this week. I'm Tanzina Vega, and happy Mother's Day to all the moms and all the people who do all kinds of mothering out there. This is The Takeaway. See you Monday.
Hey, Takeaway listeners, we've been reading your tweets and comments and posts all during Tanzina's first week at The Takeaway, and we want to give you, the listeners, a chance to take your questions to Tanzina directly. On Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, The Takeaway is hosting a Facebook Live with Tanzina, moderated by On the Media's Brooke Gladstone. It's an opportunity to ask us about the show, about this never-ending news cycle, and you can give us suggestions about what story The Takeaway should cover next. What stories are important to you? You can head over to our social media pages Monday morning for links to the event. We are on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook as well. We hope to see you there for a behind-the-scenes chat with Tanzina and Brooke Monday, 1 p.m. Eastern.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.